This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Desperate Housewives makes its national television debut today in China. And the hanky-panky on Wisteria Lane is patty cake next to the sexual revolution the Chinese themselves are in the midst of. After centuries of Confucian strictures and decades of Maoist propriety, the new free market China also turns out to be, by comparison, the free sex China. In a nation of a billion-plus men and women, it's no surprise that sex goes on. But by all accounts, China's sexual mores are in free flight as sexuality becomes a primary stage for personal freedom. And up go abortion, divorce, and HIV rates, too. Up next on Point, freedom, morality, and the sexual revolution in China. Joining me first from Beijing is Jaime Flor-Cruz. He's Beijing bureau chief for CNN. Jaime Flor-Cruz, thank you for being with us.
It's good to join you, Tom.
It's wonderful to have you. We'll talk about the why and wherefore, but give us some of the evidence first. There's been this steady stream of reports coming out of China. Paint the picture for us, Jaime. What's happened to the sexual life at least of the, I guess, the urbanized Chinese that are in the spotlight here?
Well, one symbol of this sexual revolution spreading through China is perhaps this Mu Zimei phenomenon. It's about this writer whose pen name is called Wooden Beauty in Mandarin, Mu Zimei. And she had been blogging her sexual exploits for the past 2 years, and it became so popular that she herself became the topic of heated discussion and controversy in print and as well as on the Internet, in chat rooms and bulletin boards. And basically, she graphically describes her explicit terms her hyperactive sex life, including, you know, sexual encounters with various men. And, of course, she was criticized by the official media as pornographic and corrupt, denounced for her, you know, disillusioned views on love and marriage. But she also had her share of supporters. And after months in hibernation, she's back, and scores of imitators have emerged. And all of them are, you know, plugging their pop sex blogs and all their stuff. So sex is well and alive in China, even after 50 years under Mao.
Now, the contrast to those 50 years, I guess, is what's turning people's heads, Jaime Flor-Cruz. There was almost a puritanical public position on sex for a long time. How long did that last?
Oh, well, it lasted for, almost 50 years. In fact, I've been in China for 34 years, and the first time I came to China in 1971, it was a very sexless kind of appearance, at least. People, you know, the Chinese youth especially were wearing the Mao suits, baggy pants, and no kind of obvious, distinction between, men and women. In fact, the school children and high school kids sat in separate parts of the classroom, and there was what they called the 38th parallel that separated the boys and the girls, and they walked on two sides of the street because it was so uncool to be seen together. Now, that has certainly changed, and what we've been hearing and seeing in China in the past few years, especially in the past maybe 5 years, is simply heretical by Maoist or puritanical standards.
And now we're seeing surveys finding 70% of people in Beijing have had premarital sex, compared with 15% in 1989. And you've got the blogger Mu Zimei and many, many imitators out there with her kind of very free notions. She says on her blog, "I can choose a partner. I can replace him. There are ample resources out there. I don't need to feel any responsibility toward them, nor do I need to spend any emotion." And right on she goes. She's free with many, many partners. Is this an urban phenom, Jaime Cruz or Flor Cruz, or is this also in the countryside? How widespread?
Well, I would say, of course, Mu Zimei phenom is largely in the big cities like Beijing and Shanghai. But even out there, thanks to this cheap technology like DVDs and then the Internet, people out there, even the young Chinese farmers and migrant workers, they are very active sexually. And one wonders where they get their knowledge. because their parents really were very poor teachers. Their parents grew up under Mao, and you know they were instilled with a lot of puritanical values and insights. But again, thanks to this modern technology, there's a freer flow of information, and they do it almost everywhere. I mean, public display of affection is, you know, it's out there in the parks, in classrooms, in cars, and to the point that some people are kind of scandalized just watching them. But they have lost their innocence.
We see them celebrating this sexual freedom. At the same time, there's a price for it. HIV rates, we read, up significantly. Abortion, especially among singles, up significantly. And divorce, up 21% just in the year 2003. These new and on that side of the ledger, troubling issues for China.
It is troubling. In fact, there is this the problem of how to give or provide adequate so-called sexual education. Again, many Chinese youth especially don't really know where to turn to for sophisticated or modern views on sex and sexual information. And that is why, HIV/AIDS, for example, is spreading among many Chinese through sexual relationships or unsafe sex.
Jaime Flor Cruz, you've been watching for 34 years. This may be a revolution you didn't expect. We thank you for some insight into it from Beijing today. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's good to join you, Tom.
Jaime Flor Cruz, Beijing Bureau Chief for CNN. I'm joined now in the studio in Boston by Professor Anthony Saish, Professor of International Affairs at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He also chairs the China Public Policy Program there, spent many years in China. From 94 to 99, he was representative for the China Office of the Ford Foundation. Anthony Saish, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So what do we see exactly here? Is this a new frontier of freedom being opened up when other frontiers are prohibited to the Chinese? What's going on with this sexual revolution?
Well, there's no doubt that young people are experiencing greater freedoms than they have done any time in the last 50 years. And I think the party has essentially said, if you keep this private, if you keep it to yourselves, we're not going to interfere in the way we did before. But I think we have to be careful. I think we've got multiple revolutions, if you like, taking place here, and multiple happenings. As you said with Jaime, is this just in Beijing? Is it just in Shanghai? I think in the villages, for example, we're seeing returns of many other traditional practices, buying, selling of women, rising bride price. I think we see a lot of official entertaining. We see people who were in loveless marriages from the Cultural Revolution that were made for political reasons, now realizing that perhaps true love is out there, and this is also driving the divorce rate.
Mm-hmm.
So tremendous changes at all levels of society taking place, and at a speed, I think, that we in the West just simply cannot imagine.
I guess what attracts our eye to this one is it's a vector, an angle to a more intimate understanding of what's going on in China, at least it feels from a distance, than a lot of the import, export, economic figures that we spend so much time looking at. On this particular front, what do you think this means? Is this just that Confucianism and Maoist strictures have fallen away and now it's a kind of a free zone? Is there a search for an active new sense among young Chinese of who they are and what their freedoms are, what their boundaries are?
I think that's exactly right. The problem is it's very unclear what the boundaries are. I mean, we have a party that still professes belief in socialism, that still tells young people, old people, that you get more out of the collective than you do by pursuing your own individual desires and wants.
And yet, all around them.
Yeah, all around them, exactly. Anywhere you walk on the street, life is about markets, it's about individual choices. And I think particularly since 1989, what the party has said is, look, if you don't come out and protest against us, if you don't engage in obvious political activity, we will leave you alone. But what it has meant is that there is no real moral framework in which people can place their activities. So I think we're seeing an explosion of experimentation in many, many different ways, the sexual revolution being one of the most obvious cases where there is no real guidance about what is good moral behavior anymore.
We're joined right now from Beijing by Eva Li-Inha, Until last year, she was a student at Fudan University in Shanghai, where she translated and produced the Vagina Monologues. She now works on a joint venture between Warner Brothers and China Films. Eva Li Yinhua, thank you very much for joining us from Beijing.
Nice to join you, Tom.
So tell us first, how was Eve Ensler's Vagina Monologues received in China? That's a revolution all in itself. Was this popular? Was it shocking?
Yeah, well, many people, I mean, many students wanted to see the show, and it was quite shocking to our audience in our 2 years performance, but I think it was well received because a lot of audience came to me after the performance and said they were very shocked, but at the same time moved by our performances. Mm.
Eva, you're right in the middle of the generation that we're talking about, 20-something, growing up in a very different time from your parents and certainly grandparents. Do you have a sense of a revolution underway, that you and your peers in China have a very different attitude about intimacy and sexuality than your parents did or were able to have?
Certainly. We don't behave nothing similar to our older generation. We have very little in common, you know, regards to sexual behavior and, you know, topics like that.
I mean, one thing I suppose that's changing is the access to images and media from around the world. You're right in the middle of that, working with Warner Brothers and China Films. We understand Desperate Housewives is going on the air in China today. How big an explosion has there been in Chinese access to images and media from abroad, sexual in particular?
Wow, that's huge because you have all those movies and DVDs and, you know, movies downloads. I can say that young people nowadays, as long as they have internet access, they can get virtually anything from it.
And they do, I guess, by all the evidence. Eva Li Yinhua in Beijing with Warner Brothers and China Films, translator and producer in Beijing of the Vagina Monologues. Eva, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Back in Boston, Anthony Seish, there's the voice straight from Beijing, the kind of yes and no voice, as you described it. Yes, new things and new access going on here. No, not entirely cut free from morality of the past. And yet, in a society where tradition was so powerful for so long, this does seem like a new degree of freedom.
Well, I think it's one way that people are experiencing their personal freedoms. But, you know, old habits die hard. Let's think about Shanghai in an earlier time. You know, the Sin City.
Right.
Everybody, you know, used to think of Shanghai as associated with prostitution, with drugs, with gambling, with a wild sort of atmosphere. So this is not totally outside of the range of China's traditions. And if we think back before the Communist Party rule, there was a lot of sexual activity in urban China, and I think we're seeing the restoration of that. We know if we look at Mao Zedong's own exploits, the great leader of the Chinese Communist Party, he wasn't adverse to certain sexual antics, even though he denied those to the people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, we're seeing the rebirth of things that have happened before. I think you're certainly right that we're seeing this as a boundary that can be pushed, where young people are experimenting. And I think for young people, it's exciting. But as your last speaker said, it's very unclear to know how pervasive this is and where boundaries really lie.
Joining us in the studio is Helen Saoshou. She, Ho Saoshou, a PhD student in sociology at Boston University. She's from the Chinese city of Nanjing. Helen, thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be here.
So here we are, as Carrie says, our caller. She was there in 1999. Mm-hmm. It seemed almost like a veil of ignorance and silence around sexuality. Now very public, very much more out in the open. Is this the trademark of your generation, Helen?
I think it's very hard to generalize because there's so many like diversity here in China, and there's the rural China part, the more urbanized cities, and there are like people from different family backgrounds. But obviously, it's like more people feel like more comfortable talking about sex in public. But I still don't think there's this conversation between parents and children, though.
Because it's too difficult. The parents, the parents' standards are so different.
Yeah, I think like for most of the younger generations, they basically get their sex education from the media, from movies, from the internet.
Because it's still not in the schools? Is there still a kind of prudishness in Chinese schools? There was for a long time.
Yeah, the government, I think, is trying to relaxing the policy now, because according to the law, like females are allowed to get married at their 20s. At the age of 20, and mm-hmm. male at the age of 21.
Mm-hmm.
But usually during their studies, like as undergraduate at universities, they're not allowed to get married. But now there's no such restriction on marriage
right.
during their study.
And what about the relation between this generation and their parents? Do you see a kind of generation gap there, a kind of lack of understanding? Are young people turning to sexuality as a way of pushing away their parents' moral standards, looking for their own?
I think some people may know, like, China is practicing one-child policy.
One-child policy for many years, since 1979 or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's, because the children is like the focus of the family, and so there's probably this tension between parents and children, and children want to show their independence, freedom,
mm-hmm.
so maybe more rebellious than the previous generations. But it's still hard to generalize there. Yeah, there.
Even there, I'm sure. Anthony Sayce, just review for us for a moment. The late 70s, China, very worried about the population explosion coming, put down these strictures on childbearing, one per family. Describe the effects of that over time for us.
Well, it's one per family in the urban areas. In the mm-hmm. countryside, it's always been somewhat more relaxed. What it has led to is really a very strange demographics, where you have most of urban China focusing on the needs of their one child, pampered children. We hear these phrases of little gods, little emperors.
Right.
You just go to the shopping streets. They used to be Spartan. They used to be bare. Some of the most splendiferous shops now are the toy shops for the kids. And I think as that generation is growing up, being pampered, being feted, as they come into young adulthood, they're not willing to listen necessarily to their elders, to rules, to regulations.
If they want something, they'll have it.
They're much more direct, yeah. I mean, I've always been given it. I've always, you know, stepped my feet and I've got what I've wanted. And a number of people are concerned about this, whether this is breeding a selfish generation, what the consequences may be. If we look at the long term, the consequences are dire for China.
I mean, why?
Well, China will move. We always think of China as a young, bustling country. By the middle of this century, it will be the oldest country in the world.
That is, the one-child policy built in a kind of cliff that will suddenly appear, and the average age will drop precipitously.
It's already appearing. Average age is going to go up by about 13 years. We're going to have a country, the first in history, that will be old before it's rich. And I think secondly, what your caller just alluded to is the second problem, that we're seeing this huge distortion between males and females. And
that is many more males, because when they were restricted to one child, Chinese families looked at the sonogram and made decisions about what babies would be born and which weren't.
Yes, and if you look at some of the richest counties in the south of China, the ratios are 140 males to 100 females now. And
wow.
That's because they have the technology, they have the money to make selective abortion. So we're looking at possibly 100 million unmarried males by the middle of the century. So Miss Mu Zemei, she's going to have a lot more choice by the middle of this century than she has even now.
Anthony Sayce, what about the issue of China's moral touchstone? Confucianism was so aggressively pushed away in the Cultural Revolution and in the Mao years around it. Now, a kind of free market rejection of the tenets of Maoism, the moral components there. What does China look to? Do you see tradition reasserting itself or not?
I think you do see tradition reasserting itself. If you move away from the large cities and you go back to the villages, the temples, the places of worship have been revived. Local religious leaders are often more important than local Communist Party secretaries. China itself, even at the national level, has been flirting with a kind of neo-Confucianism. You know, let's bring some of the Confucian tenets back. But of course, they choose the ones that make the population very subservient to
mm-hmm.
the leaders. They
mm-hmm.
stress obedience. They stress people's obligations. They don't talk so much about rights. But I think you've touched on the core question here, that there is no doubt that there's a moral vacuum in China. And people are trying to fill that in different ways. The rise in religion, for example. worshiping
both traditional Chinese and Christian
and Christianity. I mean, belief in Protestantism in different types of Christianity has gone up quite rapidly in urban areas. We've seen people moving to traditional Taoist, other practices of what's called Qigong, the breathing practices. Mm-hmm. The most noticeable example being the rise of what was called Falun Gong a few years ago, which was crushed by
the great distress of the government, right?
And the government was deeply disturbed. It fundamentally challenged their claim that they are the only organization capable of giving belief to society. The fundamental problem is, of course, they're talking about a belief system that many young people and many older people don't see as valid in their everyday life.
But is there a belief system if it's this mishmash of a little bit of Maoism and a little bit of Confucius? Does it add up to a shared, coherent understanding of moral tenets?
I don't think it does at all. And I think people are fishing for things that give meaning, that explain what is out there in their life. So they think, oh, okay, that's how they do it in the U.S. Maybe that's how we should do it here.
Let's have some crazy fun.
Let's have crazy fun. People like crazy fun.
Yeah.
But it lacks the kind of moral framework that exists in the U.S. that still binds the society together. I mean, I often have Chinese friends ask me, you know, why don't capitalist countries fall apart? Isn't it all about ruthless individualism, that you're all out for yourself? You know, well, how do you hold together? Why aren't you in a continual tumultuous state? And the obvious answer is, I think, yes, we have conflicts, we have differences, but we have a basic consensus on morality in society, which is backed by a system of laws. And I think at the moment, this is China's fundamental problem, that it does not have that.
It's been a fascinating angle of insight into this culture, and I'm very grateful to both of you for helping us take it on. Ho Saoshou, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Ho Saoshou, a PhD student in sociology at Boston University, a native of Nanjing, and Anthony Seish, of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, professor of international affairs there. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Wonderful to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.